We're excited to tell you about Pine Tree Garden Seeds, a women-run, family-owned and operated business since 1979, founded with the simple mission of offering low prices on quality seeds to the home gardener. Over the years, offerings have expanded to include over 1,300 varieties of seeds, including many heirlooms and organics, a huge assortment of tools and gardening gear, and lots of new gardening books.
They also offer roots, plant starts, and tubers, berry bushes, asparagus roots, onion sets, hops, fig trees, sweet potatoes, dahlias, peonies, lilies, and a whole new selection of fall flower bulbs. Located in Maine, they operate out of a 300-year-old farmhouse and strive to offer the best service and products with a personal touch. They continue to hand-pack more than half of their seeds and rely on their Ballard machine from the 1890s to do the rest.
So order your seeds today from superseeds.com and use the promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's superseeds, SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024.
Fast Forward Productions, The Women Are Speaking.
So even as climate changes, and as our political climate changes, and as our social climate changes, if we understood divinity to be all changing, just like how the seasons change, then what impact would that have on our hearts and how we live together and how we live with the world?
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now, the farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
So, good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
I'm really excited about this episode today, and we'll get to introducing our guest, but this is a really fun one because the topic especially speaks to a lot of our own personal and mine being very influenced by your personal journey growing up and you being my mom and being interested in these things that I think ultimately led us to a place of starting Lady Farmer, which is really cool. So I thought that we might start out by you talking, just to brief, you chat about it a little bit in the episode as well, but just sort of your experience with, I guess, learning about eco-spirituality, for lack of a better word, and kind of how you got to be exploring that.
Oh, wow. So I guess it's kind of a long, involved story. So I'll try to think of how I can kind of sum it up a little bit. And maybe someday we can have a whole episode on the whole thing. But I think it began, I was probably in my mid to late 30s, and I really begin to question and ponder sort of the basic assumptions of conventional thinking around religion and spirituality and my own religious upbringing. And I didn't have like a big rebellion or anything. I just started thinking about things in a different way. And there are a few things I think that influenced that back at that time. One of them was that, you know, we moved to a place, we moved to Georgia where there was a lot of very rapid commercial and residential development. And we were sort of surrounded by that and lived in the midst of it. I found myself really, really affected by the destruction of the natural landscape around me. So we moved to this place that was really kind of rural and out, away from things, and just like literally week by week, it just transformed. And I found myself very, very affected by that. And, you know, I had a very conventional Christian upbringing, and we were bringing you guys up in a Christian church, a wonderful community, and that was all good. But I begin to wonder why the church in general wasn't addressing this anymore, this care for the earth, care for our natural resources. And it started to feel more and more like a conflict to me. And there were some other things that happened that made me start looking at things a little differently. And so I started on this path and I started reading things and journaling.
Going on
and
retreats. I remember you would go to stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I started exploring indigenous cultures and traditions because they were very earth-based and earth-centered. And I was very, very drawn to that. And I'll mention this one book that was very transformative to me was Sue Monk Kidd, who so many of us know now as the very well-known novelist for The Secret Life of Bees. But before that, she had written a book called Dance of the Dissident Daughter. And a lot of people know about it, but far less know about that book than her novels. So I stumbled upon that book sometime in the 90s and found that very, very, very transformative. She just hit exactly where I was in like, wow, you know, I have these feelings and I have these life events and I'm in this culture and somewhere things are sort of clashing together with things we've been taught and things we've been led to believe are good and right and all of that. So I took this path and you were just a little girl and I guess heard about it and absorbed some of it.
Yeah. And I think that occasionally we'll have an interview like this on here that's much more spiritual and kind of just a little more like cerebral maybe. And it's always really fun because it can feel a little different from the other kind of more concrete things that we talk about. But I think really speaks to both of our more inner journeys with everything and what led us ultimately to our project, like Lady Farmer, which started, as some people may not know, as a slow fashion line. We just wanted to design clothes that were not made with slave labor and not made from harmful materials. And it really just opened up a whole can of worms for us that led us here.
Earthworms. A can of earthworms. I want to throw in something else about that time period that I think is important that I didn't want to leave out. But I had always wanted to write. I always wanted to be a writer since I was a child. I felt like I had some stories inside me and I wanted to write a novel. And that was a period of time when I really started pursuing that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd been busy. I had been in school. I had gotten my grad degree. I'd gotten married, had kids, all that. And then I remember the very first day that all three of you guys were in school. Like the first day of school, I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I sat down at the kitchen table and I wrote a short story.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, so I did it. So that was that period of
life.
And
that's interesting because your novel didn't come out until I was in college.
Oh, listen, these things take a long time. I have stuff I've been working on for a long, long time. It's one thing I've learned that you can't be in a hurry about these things. They unfold over many years. Like we were talking about with Stephanie O'Day, just be patient with these things. But anyway, that was when you were like a little girl. So how did all that affect you? Or what did you observe? Or what do you remember from my interest in these things? Oh, and I joined a dream group and started studying a lot about Jungian psychology. And yes, I went to a lot of Jungian workshops and so forth. So yeah, it was a real opening up time for me.
I just remember you. Well, I just specifically remember you stopped coming to church with us, and then we all sort of stopped. I was the only one who kept going to church because I really liked my friends at church. But I remember, yeah, I remember you going on retreats, and I remember you sort of talking about this stuff. And I think I understood it on some level, looking back on it, and then hearing you talk about it now. Literally, I remember too, just huge strip malls and things just like popping up out of the ground or being plopped, like however you want to picture it, and large swaths of forest just being cleared, like just all around us, you know, that suburban sprawl. We like really were in it. It was really kind of, I don't know, it was really painful. And I know it was really painful for you. So that was interesting to sort of experience firsthand. And then, yeah, like I said, you would go on these like retreats. And then fast forward a bunch of years later, we start Lady Farmer and we do our own retreats with Lady Farmer, which have been interrupted by COVID, but we do hope to get back there. And then we are drawn into conversation from time to time. You know, this isn't the only conversation like this that we've had, but with wonderful people like Mary DeYoung, who is doing a lot of work in this space. Eco-spirituality to me is like the best word for it, but it really is like so much more than just eco-spirituality. So yeah, do we want to go ahead and introduce her in this conversation?
Yes. So Mary DeYoung is the person behind Waymarkers, which offers guidance and wisdom from the sacred wild. She's a spiritual ecologist, an eco-theologian, wild soul guide, urban naturalist, and the practitioner and guide of place-based pilgrimage. She specializes in the rewilding of our spiritual lives and guides others in reconnecting their inner nature to the regenerative rhythms of our local bioregions.
Mary facilitates retreats and pilgrimages in the Pacific Northwest and in Iona, Scotland, that strengthen the mystical interconnection between participants, the sacred, and the more than human world. She has studied and practiced within the Celtic Christian spiritual tradition for over 25 years and is influenced by the lives of Celtic saints and the lands that guided them. Mary terms this work sacred eco-awakening, as it allows us to come to terms with our human history and to rediscover our place within the whole of creation.
This was really a moving conversation in which we talked about reconnecting with the earth as sacred, and we discussed seeking our own indigeneity, which is very fascinating, and shifting from the mindset of separation and rewilding our inner selves in order to restore our outer landscape, which is an amazing topic. We're so grateful to discover Mary and her work. Talking to her was a deep dive into some really big questions, and we loved every minute of it. So here is Mary DeYoung of Waymarkers.
My name is Mary DeYoung, and I'm a spiritual ecologist and eco-theologian and wild soul guide. I love companioning people through a journey that reconnects them to a sense of this sacred earth, the sacred that is within them, and how to engage the holy right here in our landscapes, in our bioregions. So there's this sense that we are all coming from such different places. We are all located literally in different landscapes, in different bioregions, in different cultures, in different corners of this great planet. And that informs how we understand ourselves, how we understand the sacred, and how we understand the more than human world. So then we come together in conversation, and we're coming from such different places that I think is where a lot of tensions can lie in trying to express our understanding of self, sacred, and the more than human world from our locatedness. But what gets interesting then is, you know, we might have tension around language, we might have tension around ideology, around theology, but when we hold the earth in our hands, that becomes a common lexicon. It's a common text from the great library of humanity. It's like, okay, we can open up this, and now we can enter into awe and wonder from that kind of common expression. Who is the sacred through the trees? Okay, yeah, let's try to sense into that. Or the type of soil or the type of watershed. Let's express and come around a common idea through the landscape. I see this as a work of reclamation, of reclaiming an old ancient story that we as Western civilization, I think, kind of divorced from long, long ago. And it's a story of severance. And I think that we get to reclaim a deeper story. And that's one of interconnection, that we are all connected.
Oh, so cool. So Mary, how did you start out in your journey?
So I'll place myself, because I think that's a big part of my journey. So I'm in the Pacific Northwest, which is the greater kind of Seattle area, the land of the Duwamish and the Snohomish people, many, many other tribes up along Cascadia. But I grew up in the town of Snohomish, and I now reside in Seattle. And growing up, I was in a household that was very Christian, very evangelical, and I would split Sundays with my mom and my dad, who were married and happily, but my dad was actually an atheist, but a mountaineer. And so every other Sunday, we would go out into the lowlands of the North Cascades, sometimes up into the hinterland as well, and hike and climb and ski and backpack. And in these two different contexts, I received a profoundly different story about who I was. And that, I think, was my starting point of what has been my life's work, of recovering a story of ultimately inherent dignity for myself and for the earth, and to really call to account theological stories and ideologies that would somehow give us a message that our bodies are depraved and the earth is somehow fallen, right? So these are narratives, these are stories that if you've come up and through the Christian church, this would sound somewhat familiar. Thankfully, I think we're coming to a place where many are like, oh, heck no. Like, that's so not healthy. Yeah. So that would have been my starting point as a young girl, really kind of wrestling with, like, it's not true that I'm not good. It's not true that the earth, the beauty of the North Cascades, if you've been out in this corner pocket, like, it's mind blowing. Like, how could this not be good? And so seminary and postgraduate work in eco-psychology and eco-mythology has all been around, I think, an attempt to do this, some intersectional deep digging into finding a primeval story of sacred belonging, that I belong here. We belong here as humans to this planet. And that sense of belonging, I think if we start our stories from there, I think that's really powerful.
It's really amazing that your parents were married atheist and an evangelical Christian. Wow.
Yeah, they shared a love for the natural world. I think that was where they met, for sure. My dad since converted, but has never, ever hung up his backpack and his love for the natural world. And I'm so, so grateful for that.
That's wow. And it makes so much sense, too. That would be your beginnings. It's like one foot in each world.
And how you integrated all of those experiences and all of that messaging and how that has come together for what you're doing now. And something that really speaks to me as an integration of the good dirt, the things we talk about so much on here, and your work. We talk a lot about rewilding the landscapes and what that means. And there's so many different interpretations of that, and the contextualization of that can really vary. But I've listened to some of your interviews and so forth, and I love how you framed your work as a rewilding of our inner landscape. You know, we talk a lot about the outer landscape and how to bring back what is wild and how to bring back what is native. And so just to turn that inward, I would love to hear you talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it? It's such a fascinating project to mirror that sort of rewilding outer landscapes into our own inner wilds, this inner nature. And I think to even begin that conversation, it has to be kind of established that we are nature. So that would be a story that we have to, like, reclaim. A lot of theologies, a lot of ideologies would have been telling a story for thousands of years that we aren't nature, that humans somehow are superior to the natural world, you know, above it. That's what gives us the right to dominate it, to utilize it as resource for our own needs. And so to go into more of a spiritual ecology framework would be to claim that we are nature. So if this then is true, all of these wild landscapes, all of these domesticated landscapes also reside within our bodies. And we share the same heritage, we share the same lineage as the land. We've just passed through Ash Wednesday a couple days ago. And if you're familiar at all with that liturgical tradition, which begins the 40 days of Lent, this is a time where historically or traditionally you would receive a mark of a cross with ash as a reminder, from dust we have come, to dust we will return. I love to play with that and invert it, or maybe expand it into a story that's more cosmic in nature, and reclaim that we actually are made of stardust. From stardust we have come, to earth dust we will return. That's another reclamation of our common heritage with the land, is that of stardust. And when we can reclaim that sort of, like, family of origin story, if you will, you know, like, we all have that, we all have that origin, then the idea then that we too are nature, just like the external world is nature, it's not such a hard leap. So then we do these projects of restoring landscapes, of rewilding landscapes, bringing them back into wholeness. And we can look inward and acknowledge, oh, there have absolutely been landscapes within me that have been devastated, that have been demolished, that have been clear-cutted, that have been dammed. All of those things are happening in our internal worldscape, our internal soulscape, our wild nature. We too, as humans, or even our particular selves, will experience the same sort of degradation that external landscapes are going through when apex predators have been annihilated, when the dams have been put up, when the trees have been logged. And so it becomes a very interesting way to begin to do like soul recovery work or spiritual formation from this idea of rewilding. Rewilding is to bring relationships back into wholeness, and wholeness and holiness share the same etymological roots. So rewilding really is holy work. It's sacred to bring these landscapes, external and internal, back into wholeness.
Oh my goodness, this is resonating so much. And I want to go back just a little bit where you began to say, we are nature. And this is something I think about so much because I think intellectually we know that, but the language we still use even today, even as we understand the interconnections of all life on Earth and our cellular connections with the soil, and even though we know all this intellectually, we still use language that perpetuates this idea of separation.
Absolutely.
We say we are connected to nature. We say we need to connect with nature. And we advise people to go out and get their daily dose of nature. And all that is correct. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's, correct me if I'm wrong, it still doesn't translate into our minds that it's not us and it. It's all. It's everything.
Yes, these narratives continue to externalize the natural world and make it an it, and then there's us. So there's this posture of we're still separate.
Yeah, it's something we need to pursue. It's something we need to protect. Yeah. It's
even saying the natural world being like there's a natural world, so then there's an unnatural world, and it's almost the language we have isn't, it's almost impossible to really encompass it.
The language doesn't hold the truth of it, I guess is what I'm getting at. And what I want to ask you that's sort of related to that is, where do you think this, you spoke of it in terms of a divorce or a severance, where do you think this happened, this division in our psyche and our understanding of our place on the planet that even led to the development of the language that perpetuates this idea and the way we live on the planet and the whole ethos of we don't have to follow the rules of nature. We can ignore the rules of nature if it means that we can make more money or profit from something. It doesn't matter. That becomes secondary. When the truth of it is that we're actually hurting ourselves when we destroy the earth. And again, I think somehow we know that on an intellectual level, but it just hasn't reached the point of like really knowing. So I want to ask you, how did this happen? I mean, there's probably not one answer for that, but what do you think in all your studies? You've been in this a while.
Yeah, it's such an important question. And I think it actually lands us back into the realm of story. And it gets at how critical and integral the stories we tell are in how we live out our lives. And so let me just do a real broad stroke work here. And this won't do all of the good thinking and good research and work that has been done any justice, not just by myself, but by a whole host of others. But we've got to go back thousands of years. We've got to go back thousands of years to a time where most indigenous cultures and communities did have a concept of divinity or deity being the land, and that the land was in some way, shape, or form, a part of the body of a greater deity, whether it was a foot of a god or the belly of a god or the child or the product, the byproduct of divinity, that the earth was held in that sort of worldview. If the earth is deity, if the earth is divine, all the trees, all the features, you know, I think about the big mountains and the seascapes and all of the wildlife that lives within it. If that is all holy, how then do human beings interact with all of those wild others. It's probably in a posture of deep, like, humility and honor and awe and wonder, you know, like, how amazing is it that we get to walk and live with the gods? Okay, so this is thousands of years ago. As the Western imagination began to take root, and I think ultimately this is a power play. This is the beginning seeds of empire and dominion. There had to be a new story that was told that extracted divinity from the land. And so the beginning of what would be called sky god religions began to take hold in the imagination and then begin to show up in kind of all corners of the world. But there was an extraction of the sacred, leaving then the soil as just stuff that can be utilized, I mean, really abused for the human agenda. So in that move, we are able to have capitalistic ideas form and merge. You're able to engage in all forms of, I guess, the natural world. And here's the separation, right? We've been telling this story for so long that our language now doesn't even have the ability to connect to the body of the earth as sacred. So, Mary, what you're saying before is like, how do we even talk about this without perpetuating the severance? But that would be what I would say in broad stroke and probably the simplest of terms, that we started telling a different story, that God wasn't walking in the garden with us.
And who did it? Like, this is so confusing to me. Like, was this like product of like some kind of cultural evolution or something, where the human brain developed to a point to where it began to view things in this other, through this other lens? Or was it agriculture? Or was it political fear? You know, certain powers had to develop narratives that frightened people into thinking a certain way? I mean, or a combination of all these things?
I think it's a combination. I think that you're holding a lot of different threads that ultimately were braided all together to be a rope that has literally been killing us and how we're meant to be on this planet and killing the earth herself. I believe that. But I think that there was at some point an understanding that if power and empire were to be the agenda, because I think somehow, and this, you know, and we're not going to do any work around the concept of evil or sin. That would be, we'd have to go on a long, long retreat to do that kind of work. but you can begin to get a sense for maybe a subversive presence, or I think power in and of itself is always going to demand we tell different stories. Power with a capital P will say, we're not connected. You don't belong here, so that power can grow and become more dominant, more oppressive. And there was something that would have begun to happen, I think, as probably cultures began to interact and mesh. And maybe there were tensions from different imaginations of the divine and different ways of living life culturally, that there begins to be some sort of attempt to power over and to dominate. And then you create a story that the more powerful group says is superior. And then that story begins to elevate and elevate and elevate and become the seat of power in and of itself. And so then a worldview that is deeply connected to the earth in a sacred way, I would call that a sacramental worldview, that becomes inferior. That's an inferior story to one of separation that allows for power, dominance, and control. And so I think that's the place where we now wrestle, because we're coming to terms with the severe damaging outcome of telling this story for far, far, far too long. So then my question, I guess, and this is probably at the heart of my work, is how do we return to the old stories? And not even just as a way to go back to old ways, ancient ways, primordial ways of speaking about the land and divinity, but more like, how do we recast it in our modern lives, in the reality of the times that we're living in?
And I'd like to say, you know, it's possible to just, we're not talking about everyone go be a pagan. We're really, what I hear you saying, and things I think about are a lot, or how do we reframe what we have, you know, or whether, you know, we come from whatever spiritual context you find yourself in, whatever traditions, whatever background, it can be reframed to include this, what I love the word you use, the sacramental worldview. You know, we're not going to offend our Christian tradition by treating the earth as sacred.
Absolutely not.
When I hear you talk about that more, how can we do that? How can we include that into our current context without feeling threatened, without feeling like we're in conflict with each other or our own traditions even? I mean, how do we do this? It's so necessary.
I know. Right. Well, we've got to decouple it from power. I mean, and this is, you know, we're coming up into a, you know, an intense political year. It's already intense. It's been intense. And no matter what color we are or how we vote or how we understand, I think, ourselves in this greater political context, what is common is the earth. We all stand on it. Our lives depend on it. And so it's almost like if we can reclaim that commonality, maybe that allows us to not feel afraid of a conversation that would transform us, reform us back into an integral relationship with planet Earth. Conversation's an important word. I am a word freak. My BA was in English literature. I love, love, love looking deep into etymology of word connections. And conversation ultimately means kind of two people are face-to-face having a conversation, a true conversation. Both hearts must be willing to be changed by the other. If what I'm saying could convert you, and if what you're saying, I'm open to it converting me, that's a conversation. So you can feel, I can feel my heart just opening up to like, ooh. So if we can come to each other with that sort of heart open willingness to be transformed by the possibility of the words that I'm saying and the possibility, I think, even of the words that the listeners would be thinking in receipt of this, could that land us safely back on the earth in a way where we're not fighting its natural systems? We're not trying to reroute rivers and take down mountaintops and drill the essential oils that really need to remain below the mantle. We land there and not have that become a political placement, but rather we're back on sacred soil now. Can we, that be the starting place?
Yeah. I think the problem is people don't want to be converted. No one wants to do that because it would mean that they're wrong or something.
Well, I think it would mean like what we're talking about here is like a real paradigm shift. We talk about paradigm shift a lot on this show and how we think, like the starting point from where decisions are made as individuals and as larger communities and government. And the starting point is not, you know, our entire system is not Earth first. And what if it was? What if it was the Earth first? Because the Earth is the source of all life, even ours. That's not an understanding. That's not an assumption. So what can we do as individuals and what do you, in your work, I guess, you know, we talk about it and we try to make decisions in our lives that illuminate these things for people. And, it, you know, I guess it's a very small revolution, you know?
It happens locally. We have these conversations that take us back, you know, millennia, and we're talking globally, and our mind begins to collapse because it's too much. It's too big. And so there's this idea of the cosmolocal, that all of these patterns that exist within the cosmos from the great flaring forth 13.8 billion years ago to where we are now. How do we localize all of that? And so ultimately, I think what matters the most is how do we as individuals take up the possibility of being transformed, of being converted, of being restored back to a story, a narrative of sacred interconnection? And then how does that change how we live, how we are emplaced in our little corner of the world? It all has to start locally. You know, so then I think the way that we all begin to tend, like literally tend the earth right beneath our feet, becomes a powerful expression of this story. And we know from metaphysics, like how the movement of a butterfly's wings can change earth patterns all across the world. How one pebble dropping, you know, and, you know, I think about, right, you know, when my sons throw rocks into the Salish Sea, that there's reverberations that extend halfway across the globe. So there's power in the particular. And maybe that kind of allows our nervous system to kind of settle, like, okay, you just ground back down.
When you said that, it allows our nervous system to, what did you say?
Just ground. Like, literally just come back down, right?
I literally felt that when you said to go local, because I think we can handle that. We can handle that in our head. We can handle thinking about what we can do in our backyard or in our little flower pot on the patio.
Even. Yes.
We can do that. We like to tell people what they can do.
Yes. And I think it's empowering to know that if we want to somehow categorize them as like smaller acts, just to make them more manageable, but to know that they are so powerful and it has far, far reaching results. One of the projects that I've been involved in for the past 17 years locally, kind of another hat that I wear is as an urban naturalist, and I've been the community lead of a project, and it's a rewilding project in a 43-acre urban forest right here in Seattle. It's in the city. We're not beyond the city limits. We are squarely in Seattle, and it's been a project of restorations, restoring the land, but also restoring the land. I don't know if you can hear that subtlety. So we're telling a new story about this particular urban landscape that had been so degraded. I would even say forgotten. The consciousness of our community did not hold this particular landscape in its imagination. So this is the Chisti green space, or Kwatsich is the Lesuchit name for it. And in the Lesuchit language, it translates into green and yellow spine. And this 43-acre wood at one time would have been covered with trees that in the changing of seasons would proclaim green and proclaim yellow along this hillscape. But because of logging and just kind of social realities in Seattle, like, the land had really become very, very degraded, overrun with ivy and blackberry, and had become a monoculture, which does not serve biodiversity. It does not serve life. And so the restoration has been to remove a lot of these, you know, these plants that just grow to abundance if given the right conditions, which is essentially deforestation. And then planting what is now the forest of our local communities, our future forest now. And we've been at this work for about 17 years. And in that, telling a new story of this landscape, that it's meant for connection. We're meant to be in it, actually. We're not meant to be separate from it. And that's a local action that we've been a part of. Like, for years, we've been committed, dedicated, loyal to this work. And just yesterday, we were out walking in the woods, and there were bald eagles flying overhead. It's important to note that, because 17 years ago there weren't, because hunting grounds were, you couldn't hunt with the amount of ivy and blackberry on the ground, but also bird biodiversity is a key indicator of healthy ecologies. So when the birds are flying, when you see birds around your yard, your neighborhood, and when there's a diversity of them, that's like that's a red letter day for something's going right. And in that sense, if something's going right, there can and should be a sense of, like, love and connection and leaning into whatever those behaviors are that are benefiting biodiversity. And I think that relates to the stories that we tell. We tell stories in our local landscapes that we can restore the land on behalf of life. We'll begin to see it.
Yes.
It'll take time, though. It's a slower time frame.
In many cases, it goes beyond our lifetimes. On the other hand, you can see things happen really quickly, you know, when you do this sort of thing. And I'm curious to hear, you say you've been involved in this project for 17 years. What are the specific things, actions that you all did? I imagine you went in and you took out the blackberries, but what was the process of reclamation? And I realize it's going to be ongoing, but can you just sort of give us a glimpse of what that's involved?
Categorically, we're working within a green space landscape, which at least in our city has a different designation than parkland. We began when we had the imagination for a restored forest that would provide safe and welcoming access to the natural world for urban youth. We had to go against policy and ultimately power. So in land, And so I think we've kind of already spoken about how, again, the stories that we tell kind of can, you know, cause severance and separation. When you're working with land, you're beginning to work with some of the foundational energies of, I think, human society as well as the earth, and it's ultimately power. Well, this is more from the human construct. But so when we began to say, hey, safe welcoming access into these 43 acres, we began to realize that we were poking a much bigger beast. And so a lot of our work was in the realm of advocacy and community organizing, just to begin the work of restoration for access, recreational access. And I would name that there was that work. But then when the restoration work really began, it was removing the ivy, removing the blackberry, you know, in our bio, in this context. And then literally tons, no joke, tons of garbage, tons of waste,
I still just shake my head when I think about some of the things that we would uncover and move out.
But doing this also in community. There are thousands of people and thousands of volunteer hours have gone into this imagination. And then planting. So every year we are planting thousands of trees and understory plants that are native to our bioregion that contribute to a thriving ecology. Mortality rates are real, so not everything survives. About 50% of what we plant every year does die, and that's increasing because of climate change. We worked on developing a trail plan. We got grant money for trail work, and then there was trail building. And so now, 17 years later, what we see is this landscape is a central connector for commuters, pedestrian commuters. We have preschools that walk their children into the woods, and the kids are playing in the woods. Students are walking to school through the woods. Like, it's become a landscape that provides connection and recreation. People are running in there, you know, walking their dogs, being. Some of the work that I do is in kind of like eco forest bathing or eco spiritual direction. And I'll bring clients out in the woods, and we just are able to be in the woods in a way that 17 years ago you would not have been.
Oh, it's just so amazing.
Here are some things we love about Pine Tree Garden Seeds. For one thing, they're lady farmers. It's a woman-owned and woman-run company. 85% of their staff is female.
And they've recently switched to a more sustainable envelope to ship seeds. Their new mailers are completely recyclable, made of paper and a cushioning material that is specifically designed to easily separate from the paper fibers during the repulping and recycling process.
They're also longtime members and supporters of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and signers of the Safe Seed Pledge, promising to never knowingly sell any GMO seeds. They do germination testing throughout the year on every single seed variety they carry, so they can stand behind their viability guarantee.
Pine Tree Garden Seeds is meant for every level of expertise, for the yard artists, the backyard growers, the herb explorers, the bouquet builders, the habitat curators, and beyond. They're committed to helping you get the most out of your home garden by providing high-quality garden seeds, plants, and supplies at an affordable price. Get your spring garden going today by ordering your seeds from superseeds.com and using our promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024. I would love to hear more about your work. A little bit of your study and your teaching in the Celtic tradition, Celtic spiritual traditions. And we are very drawn to that. And I think a lot of folks drawn to this podcast are also drawn to that. And for instance, we love St. Bridget and sort of her, just everything that she represents and the Celtic tradition of St. Bridget as well. And then also your trips to Iona. That's amazing. And I would love to hear about your work there.
Well, you know, Emma, you made a comment earlier on about, I think in response to my upbringing, being a sense that I had like my feet in two worlds. And I feel like that's a real beautiful way of actually talking about the Celtic tradition, which is this sense that we do have our feet in two worlds. We have our feet firmly planted here on the ground. And we also have a foot kind of planted in the eternal. So that would be kind of part of the Celtic of imagination, that you are always walking in two places. So that means that if you're straddling that kind of reality, ultimately those two realities, your midpoint holds it both. So within your midpoint, everything ultimately is sacred. There's not a sense of like the secular and the mundane and then, you know,
on the other side of it all, or within Christian walls, is the sacred, the sacrament. The Celtic worldview says that no, we are walking in both of those worlds all of the time. Therefore, everything is sacred. And then another like straddling that the Celtic tradition invites us into, and this is a sense that it's been said that Christ walks with two shoes. One is Christian scripture and the other is the natural world. And without either, there's a sense that Christ has been limping for a long time because we have taken off his shoe of the natural world. And that gives expression to this idea that while we have our sacred scriptures, those are secondary to what would be understood as the primary text of creation. And that quite literally for billions of years, the natural world has been proclaiming these sacred wisdom truths without the help of the human tongue or even, you know, human script. And so the Celtic imagination returns again and again to the primacy of creation. So my spiritual practice is through the Celtic tradition. I've been practicing in that lane for 25 years. It's my matrilineal line. So it's interesting because there's this invitation then. And again, like I had every single devotional that would have been hot stuff, right, in the 80s and 90s. And I had my morning devos and, you know, I had all that growing up. But it's like, so now I'm at this place where I close the books. And in many ways, that's like the intellectual mind as well. Like I'm really trying to close that and walk out my door. And in that threshold crossing of walking through my door, and there is Brigid right there at the threshold. You know, she's the patron saint of birth and thresholds and midwifery. I walk out my door and my curiosity, my longing, my desire is, how do I read redemption through the spores of a sword fern? Or what is the story of, I don't know, the perennial wisdom of like resurrection, right? Everything has this pattern. There's this perennial pattern that I think the Christ story patterned after becomes almost secondary to this primeval pattern that is within the natural world. How do I read that in my tulips? How do I read that in Western cedar? How do I read about love and inclusivity and service in my ecosystem? And that is a Celtic worldview. And so my work is then in companioning people, myself included still, like how do we do this? How do we read wisdom in the wild, in these wild places? And wild doesn't have to be the wilderness. You don't have to be in New Mexico, I don't know, on like 500 acres, you know, to have this sort of possibility. I live squarely in an urban context. If you were to go out my front door, there's an arterial that runs right, you know, we're two blocks away from a light rail. SeaTac Airport runs right above us, but I have a 43 acre wood behind me. I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in the dandelion that cuts through the concrete. And how do I read that dandelion for hope? How do I find the story of salvation in the soil that is beneath my feet here?
I think it's so fascinating that you said there's a point where you close the book and you go out and you immerse yourself in creation, the natural world, even though you're in an urban environment, you are still in the midst of creation. And you talk about the primacy of creation, it being at the root of the Celtic wisdom. And I don't know, are you familiar with a book? I must have read it at least 20 years ago. It was called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And it's written by the brain surgeon named Leonard Schlain.
No, but I want to read it.
So this book has stuck with me all this time. He sort of talks about, you know, the history, you know, human evolution and the history of human civilization. And he talks about how when written language came into the human experience, the brain changed. Human brain evolved in a way where it could create and communicate through written language. But there was a time before this and there was a time afterward. And so, you know, if you, and from here, I'm getting really general, but that's, you know, that's the basic idea of it. But if you look at what happened, you know, after written language, then we begin to have, you know, the written scriptures and the words that, you know, entire societies turned to for guidance. And the humans, we sort of left behind the language, the linguistics of creation, as you are describing right here. So your work is not to reject what we have, not to reject our current traditions or teachings or scriptures, but to go back and embrace all of that that set the stage, all of that, the primacy of what came before the written rules, the written guidance, and create a more holistic approach to humans' relationship on the planet.
I love that, Mary. Yeah, well, I need to read that book. There's something that we did, and I love thinking about the move towards the written word as a sort of magic that occurred. Like, we were in many ways creating symbols to evoke the imagination. And this is an idea that's talked a lot about by David Abram, who is an eco-philosopher, and kind of the magical, enchanted nature of the written word, but before the written word, and then the natural world that was meeting the pen. And then what the pen was trying to produce in the imagination becomes a really interesting intersection. We were trying to codify some sense of the sacred by writing it down and creating human symbols for it. But I think what has happened is when we codify the sacred with a static symbol, we forget that the nature of the divine, this is true of the nature of the universe, is change, is dynamic. If that's primacy, if that's the foundational truth that existed before we tried to pen down how we imagined God, then maybe we wouldn't be so afraid of change. And so even as climate changes, and as our political climate changes, and as our social climate changes, if we understood divinity to be all changing, just like how the seasons change, then what impact would that have on our hearts and how we live together and how we live with the world?
And our collective decisions and the reference point from which we make those decisions. You know, I heard you talk about the basic concept of treating the earth as God's body. Now, that's going to be a big leap for a lot of people. It's a big leap for really the Western mind. But what if that was the starting point from the decisions we make regarding our, you know, economy and our food and our clothing and all these things we talk about all the time? What if that was the beginning point? Like, how is this going to impact God's body? That sounds pretty bold.
I know it is. It's provocative. It feels kind of like you're standing at the edge of revolution at that point. Ultimately, we're playing with the imagination. You know, we were able to conceive of an imagination that the divine is a monarch. We were able to imagine a castle or a kingdom in the sky. Like, ultimately, we've got to own that sort of imagination for great mystery, divine mystery, is rooted in our concepts of power. So this is called, you know, monarchical theology that gives rise to empirical theology. So if we were to say, okay, imagination, let's exercise you a little bit. What are some other metaphors and symbols we could use for the divine?
And don't you think that when Jesus came along, he sort of helped replace some of that language?
Absolutely.
And so he helped us reimagine the divine as, well, the divine entered the world as a tiny little baby, you know, great humility, power in the small, in the small beginning, the tiny light that grew and created an entire civilization.
Absolutely. There is something of, again, this cosmic expanse of the divine coming into human form, you know, onto our particular planet. So there's this particularity to the point where Christ's teachings, Jesus's teachings, are so localized. We talk about like ecological emplacement. I love when he's talking about the lilies. Consider the lilies. In Greek, that word consider actually means know everything about the growing conditions of the lily so it will flourish. The good earth, there it is. Like, know your soil, know your zone. What zone are you in? You know,
know how much sunlight it needs, how much water it needs. Is it drought tolerant? Are the deer is going to eat it? Like, know your lilies entirely. And then from there, you will know God's love and care for you.
Yes. And he spoke of the least of these and honor the stranger, honor the poor, honor the sick. You know, he brought such humility into the language of love and compassion and the presence of the divine. And whereas, to your point, you know, perhaps the Old Testament is more about the monarchical language where you hear about the king and the Lord and so forth. So that was a huge transformation in our imagination of our relationship with the divine. So maybe we're on the cusp of another huge transformation, and hearing the word imagination so much in this discussion. And I'm understanding that imagination is really everything. I mean, because we, you know, if we can imagine the world we want to be, we can imagine our relationship with the planet and the earth, then we can create a future with that in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. The stories that we tell have such power on how we live our lives. And so remembering and reconnecting to, you know, and if it is Christianity that is your through line or your heritage, or if it's another spiritual tradition, it's remembering how those expressions of relationship with the sacred ultimately are place-based. They've come from a particular place. So there's a reconnection and a remembering of these sacred stories being connected to this planet, coming up and from this earth. And then with remembering, recalling those stories, telling those stories, telling the story about Jesus knowing the lilies so, so well, and how important and integral it is to know the lilies. And I love that Jesus, you know, kind of had this shaman-like quality of knowing the qualities of the mud so well that he could heal and restore sight with localized mud. You know, there's some divinity magic in there too, I'm sure, but still there's this sense that he's working with earth stuff. And this is true of spiritual indigenous stories the world over. So if we tell those stories, so we're remembering and reconnecting to stories that place us on a sacred planet. And that's, yeah, that's, I think, where, for me, mythology gets so, so interesting.
Are you familiar with Sharon Black?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
I adore Sharon. Adore.
We are reading her latest book for our community book club right now, Hagitude.
You're doing Hagitude.
You're doing
Hagitude. So good. So good.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So I have a question going back to the Celtic thing. There's so much awareness now of indigenous wisdom. And we're speaking of indigenous wisdom here as, you know, Native Americans. But can the Celtic traditions be considered indigenous, like European indigenous? Who were the European indigenous groups?
Well, we are all indigenous to a place. There is such a diaspora going on the world over. You know, people have immigrated and traveled from choices not their own, from absolutely trauma-imposed scenarios and situations, by choice, by suffering, have moved around the world. So it is honoring the reality of those stories of movement and migration. And yes, we are all indigenous to a place. And I think those of us who have European ancestry, who have our whiteness to account for and contend with, we are being invited into the work of ancestral connection. And doing that deeper work of finding out what your DNA says about your heritage. And then more than that, so it's more than just doing, you know, DNA and me or whatever, you know, whatever sort of DNA test.
Something 23.
23, right. You do that. Don't stop there. We've got to find where in our lineage, our ancestors had their feet on the ground and understood sacred earth connection, because it's there all over the world. And so we get to do that work, and we can do that work and feel like we're in our lane, we're not appropriating. You peel back enough layers and we recover a reality that there was a universal concept that the earth was sacred.
Yes.
Now, that would come out in various particular stories and theologies and spiritualities and foundational reality. And so we get to recover that in our own ancestral lineage. And so we could talk about Celtic culture, you know, as being, you know, naming the countries that that would have been comprised of, you know, from Wales and Ireland and Scotland and England and, you know, parts of Spain and, you know, even to far further east, some Northern Africa is included in that. And, you know, there's the cultural realities of their art and their music and their language. And I think it's true that kind of in our kind of a more modern romanticized kind of expression of Celtic spirituality is just this deep sense that the sacred world contains the wisdom of God. And that begins then to be a way that we can practice that sort of nature-based spiritual connection. But yeah, I mean, it's a big conversation for sure, Mary, and it deserves that sort of tender approach because there has been so much violence done in appropriation. And so it is so important to honor and celebrate how other cultures' imagination for God has been expressed through their wisdom ways and find those wisdom ways within our own ancestral lines. And then be in conversation. I don't think that this means that we can't be in conversation with other cultural expressions. It certainly doesn't mean that we can't learn from one another. But it does mean that because of where we are emplaced in history, we've got to do it with such care. We've just got to. Like we cannot just do the violent things that we've done historically. Again, we being just the white Western worldview mind, which is take without asking. We all belong. And that belonging has to be at the core of the stories that we tell. It does mean for those of us who have benefited from systems of all the isms, that we probably have to do a bit more work around acknowledging complicity, and then how do we then get to connection? So there might be a little bit more excavation that has to happen before we find our indigenous placement. Because what Emma reminded us, we have this story of separation that created the chain of being, or this ladder that has humanity at the top. And then you could do a micro view into that top rung of humanity and actually see that there's another ladder that was created to even create another chain of being with whiteness on top, right? So we've got to climb down that ladder. There's more rungs for us to have to climb down to get our feet planted squarely on the earth, reconnected to our own story of belonging. Are you doing your work to climb down the ladder and find your place again, shoulder to shoulder in the circle of community of creation, human and more than human alike? That's vulnerable and courageous work to take off your crown of glory, all the benefits that have come by way of that, and deny that in exchange for climbing down the ladder. But my sense is that life lived with our feet squarely on the ground, rooted in place, is far richer because our meant forness, I think, begins to spark. And we remember that we are part of a whole, that we are ecological beings. We are meant for interrelationship. That is the model of the Trinity. It's the model of ecology. And so it's worth the work. And I honor that it's hard. It's hard. It's hard to tell a new story.
Yes. I feel like I personally am on a quest to my own indigeneity and the indigenous wisdom that's in my cells that comes from my line. I want to claim that.
Yeah. And you should. And you should. And this brings us, I think, into the realm of myth. We've been here already this yes. whole time because we're talking about the stories that we tell. But Mary, that you even said that you're on a quest. I mean, that's squarely now in the realm of mythology and pilgrimage work. Let me say this about quest and pilgrimage, which are these ancient, ancient storied practices of inviting transformation into our lives. The quest and the pilgrimage round ultimately are manifestations of the heroic journey. This ancient element of transformation, a storied archetypal way of transforming ourselves by which we leave our
home, however we understand home to be. I think of it as the status quo, whatever has become normative. We want to leave it. There's something unsettling. There's an unease. There's a question that drives the quest. Maybe that question is, who am I? Or what is my indigeneity? Ultimately, that question is connected to whatever the dis-ease is about. So in ancient pilgrimages, the pilgrim would carry, actually, the question was, what ails thee? And that would be the question, or what ails me? What ails thee is the question that the pilgrim, the quester, carries into this terrain of transformation. It's deeply linked to Arthurian legend and kind of Grail mythology, where we are looking ultimately to heal ourselves and heal the world. That whatever this dis-ease in myself is, and here's rewilding, here's inner nature and outer nature. If I'm at unrest, if I'm at a state of dis-ease, then that's probably a mirror of something in the outer world that is too. And so our quests for connection to our lineage, our ancestry, our indigeneity, our quests to connect deeply to the earth, our expressions of deep desire and deep longing for something more, something else. And my sense is that that longing and that desire is being echoed around the world through all of the life forms that are currently experiencing, you know, collapse of their population. And I think climate itself, like there's something of like, what ails thee? So we go on a journey, we depart, we leave what we know, we kind of sever ourselves from the known world, and we go on this deep, deep journey. And this is kind of, in mythology, this is called the underworld. And this is where we do a lot of deep exploration and shadow work. And this is, you know, I love Sharon Blackie and how she invites what she would call the heroine's journey. It's a different approach to what we encounter in the darkness. Myths that we're probably familiar with might have, you know, like the dragon or some sort of beast that lives in the dark caves and the dark caverns. And that's the shadow self that we meet, and we're meant to vanquish it. And when we best that beast, that's when we know we've won. But here in that already, language is language of hierarchy and dominion and power over. And Sharon Blackie does such a beautiful invitation to us to say, well, what if instead of besting the beast, we befriend it and learn how to get on the back of that dragon and love it? And in that move, that's a move of integration. I mean, that's healthy psychology work. You know, you're now integrating that which had been exiled.
Gold in the shadow.
Yes.
The Jungian stuff.
Totally. Yeah. And we've exiled ourselves from this planet. That brings us right back to belonging. So we can belong again on the back of the beast. And then we return home in that transformed state. That's the story round. That's the pilgrimage round. We carry our question for the sake of our healing. And I think ultimately for the healing of the planet. That's it. Inner outer work.
So you said something on the Lady Preacher podcast. She had questions that she asked at the very end, which we do too, and we're going to get to that in a minute. I think the question was, what is something that you know? And even before you answered the question, I thought, I know what I'm going to say. And you said the same thing I would have said. And it was that when I was a child, I knew I could count on nature. I knew nature would show up in the same way. I knew that whatever went on crazy outside, there would be the seasons, and you could count on the seasons, and you could count on the sun coming up and the sun going down and winter being cold and summer being hot and all of these things. And now as I'm aging and getting in certainly into the last third of my life, I realize I don't have that certainty anymore about nature. And it's frightening to the core. And so I have to kind of deal with that on the time I have left on the planet. Maybe that is my quest. And maybe it's why I'm here in a way to poke around that question and poke around all these things we deal with. And you had a very similar answer. I don't know if you remember what you said, but it was like there were certainties that you had in your mind of things that were going to happen in terms of nature and the weather and the seasons that aren't happening.
Yes. Anymore. And I think I remember reflecting back on that question and wishing that I would have kind of landed it a little bit differently, because that unease and that anxiety and that grief that is so real around not being able to count on what we have always known to be. There's something very real about what would be called the great forgetting, and that's connected to forgetting that we are part of nature, forgetting that the earth has gone through tremendous, tremendous climate shifts, forgetting that there have been apocalypses for cultural groups, imposed apocalypses for cultural groups all around the world. And so this sense of grief and anxiety and like the world is ending, I think it's important to name that for me as a white Western woman, I might be feeling that for the very first time. And my BIPOC brothers and sisters will be being like, hey, welcome to my reality. We've lived in a state of apocalypse for millennia. So there's a sense of solidarity that I think that this invites us into, that we no longer stand on stable seasons. The anxiety that that evokes invites us into a presence of solidarity with our global community. That question, though, what am I sure of? I think as an eco-theologian, I would say that it is God is change. And so if I can hold to that, and it's not meant to pacify the reality of climate catastrophe. And it's not meant to just be a anxiety, like I'm trying to like lessen, you know, like minimize it, right? You know, loosen the valve of climate anxiety. It's more like if that is true, then I may be able to adapt better. Adaptation is an easier response to what is real instead of stiff arming and denying what is happening all around us. So there's an invitation into adaptation and evolution.
Thank you. That's an incredible answer.
I'm so excited to hear, especially Seattle, and you were kind of explaining your setup there, how you're close to public transportation and an airport. What does slow living look like in your everyday life? And how do you kind of incorporate this way of being in your life?
Yeah, it seems antithetical to the pace of the city. And yet we really do practice it. And I say we because I'm inviting my family into this. Slow living for me really is seasonal living. And in many ways, it is incorporating the Celtic wheel of the year. So it's acknowledging and living by the kind of the celebrations and festivals related to the solstices and the equinoxes. And you mentioned Brigid. So, you know, it's these cross-border festivals like Imbolc and Beltane. And there's a whole bunch you can do around the Celtic Wheel of the Year. But what I love about that seasonal attunement is that it is an invitation to slow down my expectations of my formation or of my ideas or my projects, to pace them according to seasonal expression. And so on a daily practice, that looks like almost applying that wheel of the year construct to my days, where my mornings are all about springtime and like this eastward posture of new ideas and imagination and sparks flying, and noontime is associated with summer, like the heavy work of the day. Like let's really get our hands in the soil, and we're maybe kind of sweaty, and that's this southerly summer association. And by evening time, I'm moving into the West. And the Celtic imagination always sees the West as the place of your resurrection. Like, how is your day going to end? And in a way that it gives new life. So settling the day down, the work down, so that I can like pluck the essential harvest of the day. Like, what did this day grow? What is the apple of the day? So there's a harvest sense. And the nighttime being the winter time, where you go into your dream reality and you take the story of your day into like the cloak of wisdom. And so every day kind of living that sort of slower pace, and then even trying to like live my year by that as well. Maybe new projects are only coming, like really coming into form in the spring. I'm working super hard on them in the summer, but by autumn, there's a sense of release and harvest with an intentionality of wintertime being a lot slower. And that's for regeneration, right? I mean, we know this with soil work. You cannot produce all the time. So how do we incorporate the seasons of the year, the seasons of the earth, the calendar of the earth into our daily vocational expressions? And I think even in how we live out the year of our life. For me, it slows me down and it helps me even claim, like, I cannot be summer all the time.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We're speaking our language.
Yes.
Love that so much. I can't be summer all the time. I also love that about summer too, like the lessons that summer has to teach us, which are, yes, like productive and long days and so much, but also in a way, summer, the delicious, juicy, like slowness of it too.
There's a sensuality in summer that is a huge invitation if you're willing to go there, like kind of in an erotic, like, hey, I'm not all covered up. I get to shed my furs and show some skin. Like, yeah, there's a sultry aspect to summer that.
I love it. So what does the good dirt mean to you?
The good dirt for me is a reclamation of my humanity. And again, here's some etymological connections. Mary, you were talking about kind of the humble nature of Christ and, you know, my response of my humanity being connected to humus, this earth, this quality of healthy, healthy earth. And so the good earth is saying in many ways, I think to me, that we can reclaim that earth is good. There's some really good theological work of inherent dignity in that. It's not bad earth. It's not fallen earth. It is good earth. There's dignity here. And if that inherent dignity of the earth is actually the stuff from which my body has been formed, then there is goodness within me. So it's a reclamation of, like, I'm an earth people. So talk about a kind of indigeneity and what land do we get to claim? Ultimately, we're claiming ourselves, I think, as earth people. We are of this earth. We are formed from this earth and stardust. But to have that sort of proclamation is such an empowering way to step out into the world and not walk on it, but walk with it. It changes the posture of living with the good earth and not just simply on it.
Thank you. The connections of the words humility, human, humus, humble,
humor. Yes.
And humor.
Hey, we can laugh at ourselves.
That's right, Emma. Uh-huh.
Oh, that's also great. And bringing it back around to what Christ demonstrated so often. Such good stuff,
so
Mary.
Good. I'm so grateful.
Oh my gosh, we could so go grateful. On and on. Thank you so much for this conversation. I'll carry it with me for a long, long time. And then we'll have to talk again and talk some
yes,
more.
Yes, and we'll have to go that. To Iona with yes. you. And speaking of, can you tell the audience where they can find you and learn more about your work?
Absolutely. Yes, so you would find me at waymarkers.net and also on Instagram and Facebook by the same name. That's where a lot of my writing and workshops and retreats and teachings kind of live at. So if Iona feels too far away, and those are annual pilgrimage trips that I bring groups on, or if the Pacific Northwest is not your corner of the world and rewilding retreats on Whidbey Island feel far, I do have online courses. The rewilding seasons are virtual self-paced rewilding invitations that will take you around the year in this sort of sacred deepening. And in many ways, it's cracking open the text of creation. And it's a really beautiful project that I'm really proud of that a lot of people are benefiting from. So if any of this sort of like, how do I begin? Go to Waymarkers. And that definitely is the place where my companionship would begin with you.
Awesome.
So, yeah. Thank you.
For tuning in, calling in, and spreading the good dirt. We love hearing from you. You can reach our listener voicemail at 443-459-1950. That's 443-459-1950. You can find this number in our show notes and in our Instagram profile.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at @WeAreLadyFarmer. That's @WeAreLadyFarmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on The Good Dirt.
Goodbye.